Drawlight and Lascelles were seated in the drawing-room, where Mr. Norrell and Sir Walter Pole had first met. It was a gloomy enough spot. The fire burnt low in the grate, and the candles were almost out. The curtains were undrawn, and no one had put up the shutters. The rattle of the rain upon the windows was very melancholy. "It is certainly a night for raising the dead," remarked Mr. Lascelles. "Rain and trees lash the window panes, and the wind moans in the chimney. All the appropriate stage effects, in fact. I am frequently struck with the playwriting fit, and I do not know that tonight's proceedings might not inspire me to try again. A tragic comedy, telling of an impoverished minister's desperate attempts to gain money by any means, beginning with a mercenary marriage and ending with sorcery. I should think it might be received very well. I believe I shall call it 'Tis Pity She's a Corpse.'"
Lascelles paused for Drawlight to laugh at this witticism, but Drawlight had been put out of humour by the magician's refusal to allow him to stay and witness the magic, and all he said was,
"Where do you suppose they've all gone?"
"I do not know."
"Well, considering all that you and I have done for them, I think we have deserved better than this. It is scarcely half an hour since they were so full of their gratitude to us. To have forgotten us so soon is very bad, and we have not been offered so much as a bit of cake since we arrived. I dare say it is rather too late for dinner, though I, for one, am famished to death."
He was silent for a moment.
"The fire is going out, too," he remarked. "Then put some more coals on," suggested Lascelles. "What, and make myself all dirty?"
One by one all the candles went out, and the light from the fire grew less and less, until the Venetian paintings upon the walls became nothing but great squares of deepest black, hung upon walls of a black that was slightly less profound. For a long time, they sat in silence.
"That was the clock striking 1:30, said Drawlight suddenly. "How lonely it sounds. All the horrid things one reads of in novels always happen just as the church bell tolls, or the clock strikes some hour or other in a dark house. I cannot recall an instance of anything very dreadful happening at 1:30, said Lascelles.
At that moment, they heard footsteps on the stairs, which quickly became footsteps in the passageway. The drawing-room door was pushed open, and someone stood there, candle in hand. Drawlight grasped for the poker. But it was Mr. Norrell.
"Do not be alarmed, Mr. Drawlight. There is nothing to be afraid of."
Yet Mr. Norrell's face, as he raised up his candlestick, seemed to tell a different story. He was very pale, and his eyes were wide and not yet emptied, it seemed, of the dregs of fear.
"Where is Sir Walter?" he asked. "Where are the others? Miss Wintertown is asking for her mamma."
Mr. Norrell was obliged to repeat the last sentence twice before the other two gentlemen could be made to understand him. Lascelles blinked 2 or 3 times and opened his mouth as if in surprise, but then, recovering himself, he shut his mouth again and assumed a supercilious expression. This he wore for the remainder of the night, as if he regularly attended houses where young ladies were raised from the dead, and considered this particular example to have been, upon the whole, a rather dull affair. Drawlight, in the meantime, had 1,000 things to say, and I dare say he said all of them, but unfortunately no one had attention to spare just then to discover what they were. Drawlight and Lascelles were sent to find Sir Walter. Then Sir Walter fetched Mrs. Wintertown, and Mr. Norrell led that lady, tearful and trembling, to her daughter's room. Meanwhile, the news of Miss Wintertown's return to life began to penetrate other parts of the house. The servants learnt of it and were overjoyed and full of gratitude to Mr. Norrell, Mr. Drawlight, and Mr. Lascelles. A butler and 2 manservants approached Mr. Drawlight and Mr. Lascelles and begged to be allowed to say that if ever Mr. Drawlight or Mr. Lascelles could benefit from any small service that the butler or the manservants might be able to render them, they had only to speak. Mr. Lascelles whispered to Mr. Drawlight that he had not realized before that doing kind actions could lead to his being addressed in such familiar terms by so many low people. It was most unpleasant. He would take care to do no more. Fortunately, the low people were in such glad spirits that they never knew they had offended him. It was soon learnt that Miss Wintertown had left her bed, and leaning upon Mr. Norrell's arm, had gone to her own sitting-room, where she was now established in a chair by her fire, and that she had asked for a cup of tea. Drawlight and Lascelles were summoned upstairs to a pretty little sitting-room, where they found Miss Wintertown, her mother, Sir Walter, Mr. Norrell, and some of the servants. One would have thought from their looks that it had been Mrs. Wintertown and Sir Walter who had journeyed across several supernatural worlds during the night. They were so grey-faced and drawn. Mrs. Wintertown was weeping, and Sir Walter passed his hand across his pale brow from time to time, like someone who had seen horrors. Miss Wintertown, on the other hand, appeared quite calm and collected, like a young lady who had spent a quiet, uneventful evening at home. She was sitting in a chair, in the same elegant gown that she had been wearing when Drawlight and Lascelles had seen her last. She rose and smiled at Drawlight.
"I think, sir, that you and I scarcely ever met before, yet I have been told how much I owe to you. But I fear it is a debt quite beyond any repaying. That I am here at all is in large part due to your energy and insistence. Thank you, sir. Many, many thanks."
And she held out both her hands to him, and he took them.
"Oh, madam," he cried, all bows and smiles. "It was, I do assure you, the greatest honor."
And then he stopped and was silent a moment.
"Madam," he said.
He gave a short, embarrassed laugh, which was odd enough in itself. Drawlight was not easily embarrassed. He did not let go of her hands, but looked around the room as if in search of someone to help him out of a difficulty. Then he lifted one of her own hands and showed it to her. She did not appear in any way alarmed by what she saw, but she did look surprised. She raised the hand so that her mother could see it. The little finger of her left hand was gone. Chapter 9. Lady Pole, October 1807. It has been remarked by a lady infinitely cleverer than the present author how kindly disposed the world in general feels to young people who either die or marry. I imagine then the interest that surrounded Miss Wintertown. No young lady ever had such advantages before, for she died upon the Tuesday, was raised to life in the early hours of Wednesday morning, and was married upon the Thursday, which some people thought too much excitement for 1 week. The desire to see her was quite universal. The full stretch of most people's information was that she had lost a finger in her passage from one world to the next and back again. This was most tantalizing. Was she changed in any other way? No one knew. On Wednesday morning, which was the morning that followed her happy revival, the principals in this marvelous adventure seemed all in a conspiracy to deprive the town of news. Morning callers at Brunswick Square learned only that Miss Wintertown and her mother were resting. In Hanover Square it was exactly the same. Mr. Norrell was very much fatigued. It was entirely impossible that he see anybody. And as for Sir Walter Pole, nobody was quite certain where to find him, though it was strongly suspected that he was at Mrs. Wintertown's house in Brunswick Square. Had it not been for Mr. Drawlight and Mr. Lascelles, benevolent souls, the town would have been starved of information of any sort. But they drove diligently about London, making their appearance in a quite impossible number of drawing-rooms, morning-rooms, dining-rooms, and card-rooms. It is impossible to say how many dinners Drawlight was invited to sit down to that day, and it is fortunate that he was never at any time much of an eater, or he might have done some lasting damage to his digestion. 50 times or more he must have described how, after Miss Wintertown's restoration, Mrs. Wintertown and he had wept together. How Sir Walter Pole and he had clasped each other's hand, how Sir Walter had thanked him most gratefully, and how he had begged Sir Walter not to think of it, and how Mrs. Wintertown had insisted that Mr. Lascelles and he both be driven home in her very own carriage. Sir Walter Pole had left Mrs. Wintertown's house at about 7 o'clock, and had gone back to his lodgings to sleep for a few hours, but at about midday he returned to Brunswick Square, just as the town had supposed. How our neighbours find us out. By this time, it had become apparent to Mrs. Wintertown that her daughter now enjoyed a certain celebrity, that she had, as it were, risen to public eminence overnight. As well as the people who left their cards at the door, great numbers of letters and messages of congratulation were arriving every hour for Miss Wintertown, many of them from people of whom Mrs. Wintertown had never heard. "Permit me, madam," wrote one, "to entreat you to shake off the oppression of that shadowy veil which has been revealed to you." That unknown persons should think themselves entitled to comment upon so private a matter as a death and a resurrection, that they should vent their curiosity in letters to her daughter, was a circumstance to excite Mrs. Wintertown's utmost displeasure. She had a great deal to say in censure of such vulgar, ill-bred beings, and upon his arrival at Brunswick Square, Sir Walter was obliged to listen to all of it.
"My advice, ma'am," he said, "is to think no more about it. As we politicians well know, a policy of dignity and silence is our best defence against this sort of impertinence."
"Ah, Sir Walter," cried his mother-in-law-to-be, "it is very gratifying to me to discover how frequently our opinions agree. Dignity and silence. Quite. I do not think we can ever be too discreet upon the subject of poor dear Emma's sufferings. After tomorrow, I, for one, am determined never to speak of it again."
Perhaps, said Sir Walter, "I did not mean to go so far, because, you know, we must not forget Mr. Norrell. We shall always have a standing reminder of what has happened in Mr. Norrell. I fear he must often be with us. After the service he has done us, we can scarcely ever show him consideration enough."
He paused, and then added with a wry twist of his ugly face,
"Happily, Mr. Norrell himself has been so good as to indicate how he thinks my share of the obligation might best be discharged."
This was a reference to a conversation which Sir Walter and Mr. Norrell had had at 4 o'clock that morning, when Mr. Norrell had waylaid Sir Walter upon the stairs and talked to him at great length about his plans to baffle the French by magic. Mrs. Wintertown said that she would, of course, be glad to distinguish Mr. Norrell with marks of special respect and consideration. Anyone might know how highly she regarded him. Quite apart from his great magicianship, which, said Mrs. Wintertown, there was no need to mention when he came to the house, he seemed a very good sort of old gentleman.
"Indeed," said Sir Walter. "But for now, our most pressing concern must be that Miss Wintertown should not undertake more than she is equal to, and it was of this that I particularly wished to speak to you. I do not know what may be your opinion, but it seems to me that it would be as well to put off the wedding for a week or two."
Mrs. Wintertown could not approve of such a plan. All the arrangements were made, and so much of the wedding dinner cooked. Soup, jellies, boiled meats, pickled sturgeon, and so forth, were all ready. What was the good of letting it all spoil now, only to have to do it over again in a week or so? Sir Walter had nothing to say to arguments of domestic economy, and so he suggested that they ask Miss Wintertown to say whether or not she felt strong enough. And so they rose from their seats in the icy drawing-room, where this conversation had taken place, and went up to Miss Wintertown's sitting-room on the second floor, where they put the question to her.
"Oh," said she, "I have never felt better in my life. I feel very strong and well, thank you. I've been out already this morning. I do not often walk. I rarely feel equal to exercise, but this morning I felt as if the house were a prison. I longed to be outside."
Sir Walter looked very concerned.
"Was that wise?"
He turned to Mrs. Wintertown.
"Was that well done?"
Mrs. Wintertown opened her mouth to protest, but her daughter only laughed and exclaimed,
"Oh, Mamma knew nothing of it, I assure you. I went out while she was asleep in her room. Barnard went with me, and I walked round Brunswick Square 20 times. 20, is not that the most ridiculous thing you ever heard? But I was possessed of such a desire to walk. Indeed, I would have run, I think, if it were at all possible. But in London, you know,"
she laughed again,
"I wanted to go further, but Barnard would not let me. Barnard was in a great flutter and worry lest I should faint away in the road. She would not let me go out of sight of the house."
They stared at her. It was, apart from anything else, probably the longest speech Sir Walter had ever heard her utter. She was sitting very straight, with a bright eye and blooming complexion, the very picture of health and beauty. She spoke so rapidly and with such expression. She looked so cheerful and was so exceedingly animated. It was as if Mr. Norrell had not only restored her to life, but to twice or thrice the amount of life she had had before. It was very odd.
"Of course," said Sir Walter, "if you feel well enough to take exercise, then I'm sure that no one would wish to prevent you. Nothing is so likely to make you strong and to ensure your continuing health as regular exercise. but perhaps for the present it would be as well not to go out without telling anyone. You should have someone more than Barnard to guard you. From tomorrow, you know, I may claim that honour for myself.
But you will be busy, Sir Walter, she reminded him. You will have all your government business to attend to.
Indeed, but...
Oh, I know that you will be pretty constantly engaged with business affairs. I know I must not expect anything else.
She seemed so cheerfully resigned to his neglecting her that he could not help opening his mouth to protest, but the justice of what she said prevented him from saying a word. Ever since he had first seen her at Lady Winsell's house in Bath, he had been greatly struck by her beauty and elegance, and had quickly concluded that it would be a very good thing not only to marry her as soon as it could conveniently be contrived, but also to get better acquainted with her, for he had begun to suspect that, setting aside the money, she might suit him very well as a wife. He thought that an hour or so of conversation might accomplish a great deal towards setting them upon that footing of perfect unreserve and confidence which was so much to be desired between husband and wife. He had high hopes that such a tete-a-tete would soon provide ample proofs of their mutual sympathies and tastes. Several things she had said had encouraged him to hope that it might be so, and being a man, and a clever one, and 42 years old, he naturally had a great deal of information and a great many opinions upon almost every subject you care to mention, which he was eager to communicate to a lovely woman of 19, all of which he thought she could not fail but to find quite enthralling. But what with his great preoccupation with business and her poor health, they had yet to have this interesting conversation. Now she told him that she expected things to continue much the same after they were married. She did not appear to resent it. Instead, with her new lively spirits, she seemed quite entertained that he should ever have deceived himself that matters could be otherwise. Unfortunately, he was already late for an appointment with the Foreign Secretary, so he took Miss Wintertown's hand, her whole right hand, and kissed it very gallantly, told her how much he looked forward to the morrow that would make him the happiest of men, attended politely, hat in hand, to a short speech by Mrs. Wintertown upon the subject, and left the house resolving to consider the problem further, just as soon, in fact, as he could find the time. Upon the following morning, the wedding did indeed take place at St. George's, Hanover Square. It was attended by almost all of His Majesty's ministers, two or three of the royal dukes, half a dozen admirals, a bishop, and several generals. But I am sorry to say that vital as such great men must always be to a nation's peace and prosperity, on that day that Miss Wintertown married Sir Walter Pole, nobody cared tuppence for any of them. The man who drew most eyes, the man whom everybody whispered to his neighbour to point out to him, was the magician, Mr. Norrell. Chapter 10. The Difficulty of Finding Employment for a Magician. October, 1807. Sir Walter intended to introduce the subject of magic among the other ministers by degrees, allowing them to grow gradually accustomed to the idea before proposing that they make trial of Mr. Norrell in the war. He was afraid that they would oppose him. He was sure that Mr. Canning would be sarcastic, that Lord Castlereagh would be uncooperative, and the Earl of Chatham merely bemused. But all of these fears were entirely unfounded. The ministers, he soon discovered, were quite as alive to the novelty of the situation as anyone else in London. The next time the cabinet met at Burlington House, footnote 1, Burlington House in Piccadilly was the London residence of the Duke of Portland, the first Minister of the Treasury, whom many people nowadays like to call the Prime Minister, in the French style. It had been erected in an age when English noblemen were not afraid to rival their monarch in displays of power and wealth, and it had no equal for beauty anywhere in the capital. As for the Duke himself, he was a most respectable old person, but poor man, he did not accord with anybody's idea of what a Prime Minister ought to be. He was very old and sick. Just at present, he lay in a curtained room somewhere in a remote part of the house, stupefied by laudanum and dying by degrees. He was of no utility whatsoever to his country, and not much to his fellow ministers. The only advantage of his leadership, as far as they could see, was that it allowed them to use his magnificent house as their meeting place, and to employ his magnificent servants
to fetch them any little thing they might fancy out of his cellar. They generally found that governing Great Britain was a thirsty business. They declared themselves eager to employ England's only magician, but it was by no means clear what ought to be done with him. It had been 200 years since the English government had last commissioned a magician, and they were little out of the habit of it.
"My chief problem," explained Lord Castlereagh, "is in finding men for the army. A quite impossible task, I assure you. The British are a peculiarly unmilitary race, but I have an eye on Lincolnshire. I'm told that the pigs in Lincolnshire are particularly fine, and by eating them, the population grows very stout and strong. Now, what would suit me best would be a general spell cast over Lincolnshire, so that 3,000 or 4,000 young men would all at once be filled with a livelier desire to become soldiers and fight the French."
He looked at Sir Walter rather wistfully.
"Would your friend know of such a spell, Sir Walter, do you think?"
Sir Walter did not know, but he said he would ask Mr. Norrell. Later that same day, Sir Walter called upon Mr. Norrell and put the question to him. Mr. Norrell was delighted. He did not believe that anyone had ever proposed such a piece of magic before, and begged Sir Walter to convey his compliments to Lord Castlereagh as the possessor of a most original brain. As to whether or not it were possible, the difficulty lies in confining the application of the spell to Lincolnshire and to young men. There is a danger that if we were successful, which I flatter myself we would be, then Lincolnshire and several of the neighbouring counties might be entirely emptied of people. Sir Walter went back to Lord Castlereagh and told him no. The next magic, which the ministers proposed, pleased Mr. Norrell a great deal less. The resurrection of Lady Pole engrossed the thoughts of everyone in London, and the ministers were by no means exempt from the general fascination. Lord Castlereagh began it when he asked the other ministers, who was it that Napoleon Bonaparte had feared most in all the world? Who had always seemed to know what the wicked French emperor would do next? Who had inflicted so resounding a defeat upon the French that they dare not stick their French noses out of their ports? Who had united in one person all the virtues that make up an Englishman? Who else, said Lord Castlereagh, but Lord Nelson? Clearly the first thing to be done was to bring back Lord Nelson from the dead. Lord Castlereagh begged Sir Walter's pardon, and perhaps he had not understood something, but why were they wasting time talking about it? Whereupon Mr. Canning, an energetic and quarrelsome person, replied quickly that of course Lord Nelson was sadly missed. Nelson had been the nation's hero. Nelson had done everything Lord Castlereagh said he did. But when all was said and done, and Mr. Canning meant no disrespect to the Navy, that most glorious of British institutions, and Nelson had only been a sailor, whereas the late Mr. Pitt had been everything. Footnote 2. William Pitt the Younger, 1759-1806. It is very doubtful that we will ever see his like again, for he became Prime Minister at the age of 24 and led the country from that day forth with just one brief interval of 3 years until his death. If anyone dead was going to be brought back to life, then really there was no choice. It must be Pitt. A Lord Chatham, who was also the late Mr. Pitt's brother, naturally seconded this proposal, but he wondered why they had to make a choice. Why not resurrect both Pitt and Nelson? It would only be a question of paying the magician twice, and there could not be any objection to that, he supposed. Then other ministers proposed other dead gentlemen as candidates for restoration, until it seemed that half the vaults in England might be emptied. Very soon they had quite a long list, and were, as usual, starting to argue about it.
"This will not do," said Sir Walter. "We must begin somewhere, and it seems to me that every one of us was helped to his present position by the friendship of Mr. Pitt. We would do very wrong to give some other gentleman the preference."
A messenger was sent to fetch Mr. Norrell from Hanover Square to Burlington House. Mr. Norrell was led into the magnificent painted saloon where the ministers were sitting. Sir Walter told him that they were contemplating another resurrection. Mr. Norrell turned very pale and muttered something of how his special regard for Sir Walter had compelled him to undertake a sort of magic which he otherwise would not have attempted. He really had no wish to make a second attempt. The ministers did not know what they were asking. But when Mr. Norrell understood better who it was that they proposed as a candidate, he looked a great deal relieved
and was heard to say something about the condition of the body. Then the ministers thought how Mr. Pitt had been dead for almost 2 years, and that, devoted as they'd been to Pitt in life, they really had very little desire to see him in his present condition. Lord Chatham, Mr. Pitt's brother, remarked sadly that poor William would certainly have come a good deal unravelled by now. The subject was not mentioned again. A week or so later, Lord Castlereagh proposed sending Mr. Norrell to the Netherlands, or possibly Portugal, places where the ministers entertained faint hopes of gaining some foothold against Bonaparte, where Mr. Norrell might do magic under the direction of the generals and the admirals. So Admiral Peacock, an ancient red-faced seaman, and Captain Harcourt Bruce of the 20th Light Dragoons were dispatched as a joint military and naval expedition to Hanover Square to take an observation of Mr. Norrell. Captain Harcourt Bruce was not only dashing, handsome, and brave, he was also rather romantic. The reappearance of magic in England thrilled him immensely. He was a great reader of the more exciting sort of history, and his head was full of ancient battles in which the English were outnumbered by the French and doomed to die, when all at once would be heard the sound of strange, unearthly music, and upon a hilltop would appear the Raven King and his tall black helmet, with its mantling of raven feathers streaming in the wind, and he would gallop down the hillside on his tall black horse, with 100 human knights and 100 fairy knights at his back, and he would defeat the French by magic. That was Captain Harcourt Bruce's idea of a magician. That was the sort of thing which he now expected to see reproduced on every battlefield on the continent. So, when he saw Mr. Norrell in his drawing room in Hanover Square, and after he had sat and watched Mr. Norrell peevishly complain to his footman, first that the cream in his tea was too creamy, and next that it was too watery, well, I shall not surprise you when I say he was somewhat disappointed. In fact, he was so downcast by the whole undertaking that Admiral Peacock, a bluff old gentleman, felt rather sorry for him, and only had the heart to laugh at him and tease him very moderately about it. Admiral Peacock and Captain Harcourt Bruce went back to the ministers and said it was absolutely out of the question to send Mr. Norrell anywhere. The admirals and the generals would never forgive the government if they did it. For some weeks that autumn, it seemed the ministers would never be able to find employment for their only magician. Chapter 11. Brest, November 1807. In the first week of November, a squadron of French ships was preparing to leave the port of Brest, which lies on the west coast of Brittany in France. The intention of the French was to cruise about the Bay of Biscay, looking for British ships to capture, or, if they were unable to do that, to prevent the British from doing anything which they appeared to want to do. The wind blew steadily off the land. The French sailors made their preparations quickly and efficiently, and the ships were almost ready, when heavy black clouds appeared suddenly, and a rain began to fall. Now, it was only natural that such an important port as Brest should contain a great number of people who studied the winds and the weather. Just as the ships were about to sail, several of these persons hurried down to the docks in great excitement to warn the sailors that there was something very queer about the rain. The clouds, they said, had come from the north, whereas the wind was blowing from the east. The thing was impossible, but it had happened. Captains of the ships just had time to be astonished, incredulous, or unnerved, as their characters dictated, when another piece of news reached them. Brest Harbour consists of an inner bay and an outer, the inner bay being separated from the open sea by a long, thin peninsula. As the rain grew heavier, the French officers in charge of the ships learnt that a great fleet of British ships had appeared in the outer bay. How many ships were there? The officers' informants did not know. More than could be easily counted, perhaps as many as 100. Like the rain, the ships had seemingly arrived in a single instant out of an empty sea. What sort of ships were they? Ah, that was the strangest thing of all. The ships were all ships of the line, heavily armed, 2- and 3-decked warships. This was astonishing news. The ships' great number and their great size was, in truth, more puzzling than their sudden appearance. The British Navy blockaded Brest continually, but never with more than 25 ships at a time, of which only 10 or 12 were ships of the line, the remainder being agile little frigates, sloops, and brigs. So peculiar was this tale of 100 ships that the French captains did not believe it
until they had ridden or rode to Locriste, or Camarade Saint-Julien, or other places where they could stand upon the clifftops and see the ships for themselves. Days went by. The sky was the colour of lead, and the rain continued to fall. The British ships remained stubbornly where they were. The people of Brest were in a great dread lest some of the ships might attempt to come up to the town and bombard it. But the British ships did nothing. Stranger still was the news that came from other ports in the French Empire, from Rochefort, Toulon, Marseille, Genoa, Venice, Flushing, Lorient, Antwerp, and 100 other towns of lesser importance. They, too, were blockaded by British fleets of 100 or so warships. It was impossible to comprehend. Added together, these fleets contained more warships than the British possessed. Indeed, they contained more warships than there were upon the face of the earth. The most senior officer at Brest at that time was Admiral de Moulins. He had a servant, a very small man, no bigger than an 8-year-old child, and as dark as a European can be. He looked as if he had been put in the oven and baked for too long, and was now rather overdone. His skin was the colour of a coffee bean and the texture of a dried-up rice pudding. His hair was black, twisted and greasy, like the spines and quills you may observe on the less succulent parts of roasted chickens. His name was Perroquet, which means parrot. Admiral de Moulins was very proud of Perroquet, proud of his size, proud of his cleverness, proud of his agility, and most of all, proud of his colour. Admiral de Moulins often boasted that he had seen blacks who would appear fair next to Perroquet. It was Perroquet who sat in the rain for 4 days studying the ships through his eyeglass. Rain spurted from his child-sized bicorn hat as if from 2 little rainspouts. It sank into the capes of his child-sized coat, making the coat fearfully heavy and turning the wool into felt, and it ran in little streams down his baked, greasy skin. But he paid it not the slightest attention. After 4 days, Perroquet sighed, jumped to his feet, stretched himself, took off his hat, gave his head a good scratch, yawned, and said, "Well, my admiral, they are the queerest ships I have ever seen, and I do not understand them."
"In what way, Perroquet?" asked the admiral.
Gathered on the cliffs near Camaret Saint-Julien with Perroquet were Admiral de Moulins and Captain Jumeau, and the rain spurted from their bicorn hats and turned the wool of their coats into felt and filled their boots with 1/2 inch of water.
"Well," said Perroquet, "the ships sit upon the sea as if they were becalmed, and yet they are not becalmed. There is a strong westerly wind which ought by rights to blow them onto the rocks. But does it? No. Do the ships beat off? No. Do they reduce sail? No. I cannot count the number of times the wind has changed since I have sat here. But what have the men on those ships done? Nothing."
Captain Jumeau, who disliked Perroquet and was jealous of his influence with the admiral, laughed.
"He is mad, my admiral. If the British were really so idle and ignorant as he says, their ships would all be heaps of broken spars by now."
"They are more like pictures of ships," mused Perroquet, paying the captain no attention, "than the ships themselves. But a queerer thing still, my admiral, is that ship, the 3-decker at the northernmost tip of the line. On Monday, it was just like the others, but now its sails are all in tatters. Its mizzen mast is gone, and there is a ragged hole in its side."
"Huzzah!" cried Captain Jumeau. "Some brave French crew has inflicted this damage while we were standing here talking."
Perroquet grinned.
"And do you think, Captain, that the British would permit one French ship to go up to their 100 ships and blow one of them to bits and then sail calmly away again? Ha! I should like to see you do it, Captain, in your little boat. No, my admiral, it is my opinion that the British ship is melting."
"Melting?" declared the admiral in surprise.
"The hull bulges like an old woman's knitting bag," said Perroquet, "and the bowsprit and the spritsail yard are drooping into the water."
"What idiotic nonsense," declared Captain Jumeau. "How can their ship melt?"
"I do not know," said Perroquet thoughtfully. "It depends upon what it is made of."
"Jumeau, Perroquet," said Admiral de Moulins, "I believe that our best course will be to sail out and examine these ships. If the British fleet seems likely to attack, we will turn back. But in the meantime, perhaps we may learn something."
So Perriquet and the Admiral and Captain Jumeau set sail in the rain with a few brave men, for sailors, though they face hardship with equanimity, are superstitious, and Perriquet was not the only person in Brest who had noticed the queerness of the British ships. After they had gone some way, our adventurers could see that the strange ships were entirely grey, and that they glittered. Even under that dark sky, even in all that drenching rain, they shone. Once for a moment the clouds parted, and a ray of sunlight struck the sea. The ships disappeared. Then the clouds closed, and the ships were there again.
"Dear God," cried the Admiral, "what does all this mean?"
"Perhaps," said Perriquet uneasily, "the British ships have all been sunk, and these are their ghosts."
Still the strange ships glittered and shone, and this led to some discussion as to what they might be made of. The Admiral thought perhaps iron or steel. Metal ships, indeed. The French are, as I've often supposed, a very whimsical nation. Captain Jumeau wondered if they might not be of silver paper.
"Silver paper?" exclaimed the Admiral. "Oh, yes," said Captain Jumeau. "Ladies, you know, take silver paper and roll it into quills and make little baskets of it, which they then decorate with flowers and fill with sugar plums."
The Admiral and Perriquet were surprised to hear this, but Captain Jumeau was a handsome man, and clearly knew more of the ways of ladies than they did. But if it took one lady an evening to make a basket, how many ladies would it take to make a fleet? The Admiral said it made his head hurt to think of it. The sun came out again. This time, since they were closer to the ships, they could see how the sunlight shone through them, and made them colourless, until they were just a faint sparkle upon the water.
"Glass," said the Admiral,
and he was near to the mark, but it was clever Perriquet who finally hit upon the truth.
"No, my Admiral, it is the rain. They are made of rain."
As the rain fell from the heavens, the drops were made to flow together to form solid masses, pillars and beams and sheets, which someone had shaped into the likeness of 100 ships. Perriquet and the Admiral and Captain Jumeau were consumed with curiosity to know who could have made such a thing, and they agreed he must be a master rainsmith.
"But not only a master rainsmith," exclaimed the Admiral, "a master puppeteer. See how they bob up and down upon the water, how the sails billow and fall."
"They are certainly the prettiest things that ever I saw, my Admiral," agreed Perriquet. "But I repeat what I said before. He knows nothing of sailing or seamanship, whoever he is."
For 2 hours, the Admiral's wooden ship sailed in and out of the rain ships. Being ships of rain, they made no sound at all, no creaking of timber, no slap of sail in the wind, no call of sailor to his mate. Several times, groups of smooth-faced men of rain came to the ship's rail to gaze out at the wooden ship with its crew of flesh and blood men. But what the rain sailors were thinking, no one could tell. Yet the Admiral, the Captain, and Perriquet felt themselves to be perfectly safe, for, as Perriquet remarked,
"Even if the rain sailors wish to fire upon us, they only have rain cannonballs to do it with, and we will only get wet."
Perriquet and the Admiral and Captain Jumeau were lost in admiration. They forgot that they'd been tricked, forgot that they had wasted a week, and that for a week the British had been slipping into ports on the Baltic coast, and ports on the Portuguese coast, and all sorts of other ports where the Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte did not want them to go. But the spell which held the ships in place appeared to be weakening, which presumably explained the melting ship at the northernmost point of the fleet. After 2 hours, it stopped raining, and in the same moment the spell broke, which Perriquet and the Admiral and Captain Jumeau knew by a curious twist of their senses, as if they had tasted a string quartet, or been for a moment deafened by the sight of the colour blue. For the merest instant, the rain ships became mist ships, and then the breeze gently blew them apart. The Frenchmen were alone upon the empty Atlantic. Chapter 12. The Spirit of English Magic Urges Mr. Norrell to the Aid of Britannia. December 1807. On a day in December, two great dray carts happened to collide in Cheapside. One, which was loaded with barrels of sherry wine, overturned. While the drayman argued about which of them was to blame, some passers-by observed that sherry wine was leaking from one of the barrels. Soon a crowd of drinkers gathered with glasses and pint pots to catch the sherry, and hooks and bars to make holes in those casks which were still undamaged. The dray carts and crowd had soon so effectively stopped up Cheapside, the queues of carriages formed in all the neighbouring streets, Poultry, Threadneedle Street, Bartholomew Lane, and in the other direction, Aldersgate, Newgate, and Paternoster Row. It became impossible to imagine how the knot of carriages, horses, and people would ever get undone again. Of the two draymen, one was handsome and the other was fat, and having made up their quarrel, they became a sort of Bacchus and Silenus to the revel. They decided to entertain both themselves and their followers by opening all the carriage doors to see what the rich people were doing inside. Coachmen and footmen tried to prevent this impertinence, but the crowd were too many to be held off and too drunk to mind the blows of the whip which the crosser sort of coachman gave them. In one of these carriages, the fat drayman discovered Mr. Norrell and cried, "What? Old Norrell!" The draymen both climbed into the carriage to shake Mr. Norrell's hand and breathe sherry fumes all over him and assure him that they would lose no time in moving everything out of the way so that he, the hero of the French blockade, might pass. Which promise they kept, and respectable people found their horses unhitched and their carriages pushed and shoved into tanners' yards and other nasty places, or backed into dirty brick lanes where they got stuck fast and all the varnish was scraped off. And when the draymen and their friends had made this triumphal path for Mr. Norrell, they escorted him and his carriage along it, as far as Hanover Square, cheering all the way, flinging their hats in the air, and making up songs about him. Everyone, it seemed, was delighted with what Mr. Norrell had done. A large part of the French Navy had been tricked into remaining in its ports for 11 days, and during that time the British had been at liberty to sail about the Bay of Biscay, the English Channel, and the German Sea just as it pleased, and a great many things had been accomplished. Spies had been deposited in various parts of the French Empire, and other spies brought back to England with news about what Bonaparte was doing. British merchant ships had unloaded their cargoes of coffee and cotton and spices in Dutch and Baltic ports without any interference. Napoleon Bonaparte, it was said, was scouring France to find a magician of his own, but with no success. In London, the ministers were quite astonished to find that, for once, they had done something the nation approved. Mr. Norrell was invited to the Admiralty, where he drank Madeira wine in the boardroom. He sat in a chair close to the fire and had a long, comfortable chat with the First Lord of the Admiralty, Lord Mulgrave, and the First Secretary to the Admiralty, Mr. Horrocks. Above the fireplace, there were carvings of nautical instruments and garlands of flowers, which Mr. Norrell greatly admired. He described the beautiful carvings in the library at Hertfew Abbey.
"And yet," said Mr. Norrell, "I envy you, my lord, indeed I do, such a fine representation of the instruments of your profession. I wish that I might have done the same. Nothing looks so striking. Nothing, I believe, inspires a man with such eagerness to begin his day's work as the sight of his instruments neatly laid out, or their images in good English oak, as we have here. But really, a magician has need of so few tools. I will tell you a little trick, my lord. The more apparatus a magician carries about with him, coloured powders, stuffed cats, magical hats, and so forth, the greater the fraud you will eventually discover him to be."
"And what," inquired Mr. Horrocks politely, "were the few tools that a magician did require?"
"Why, nothing, really," said Mr. Norrell. "Nothing but a silver basin for seeing visions in."
"Oh," cried Mr. Horrocks, "I believe I would give almost anything to see that magic done. Would you not, my lord? Oh, Mr. Norrell, might we prevail upon you to show us a vision in a silver basin?"
Usually Mr. Norrell was the last man in the world to satisfy such idle curiosity. But he had been so pleased with his reception at the Admiralty, for the two gentlemen paid him a world of compliments, that he agreed almost immediately, and a servant was dispatched to find a silver basin.
"A silver basin about a foot in diameter," said Mr. Norrell, "which you must fill with clean water."
The Admiralty had lately sent out orders for 3 ships to rendezvous south of Gibraltar, and Lord Mulgrave had a great curiosity to know whether or not this had occurred. Would Mr. Norrell be able to find out? Mr. Norrell did not know, but promised to try. When the basin was brought, and Mr. Norrell bent over it, Lord Mulgrave and Mr. Horrocks felt as if nothing else could have so conjured up the ancient glories of English magic. They felt as if they were living in the age of Stokesy, Godbless, and the Raven King. A picture appeared upon the surface of the water in the silver basin, a picture of three ships riding the waves of a blue sea. The strong, clear light of the Mediterranean shone out into the gloomy December room and lit up the faces of the three gentlemen who peered into the bowl.
"It moves!" cried Lord Mulgrave in astonishment.
It did indeed. The sweetest white clouds imaginable were gliding across the blue sky. The ships rode the waves, and tiny people could be seen moving about them. Lord Mulgrave and Mr. Horrocks had no difficulty in recognizing HMS Catherine of Winchester, HMS Laurel, and HMS Centaur.
"Oh, Mr. Norrell," cried Mr. Horrocks, "the Centaur is my cousin's ship. Can you show me Captain Barry?"
Mr. Norrell fidgeted about, and drew in his breath with a sharp hiss, and stared fiercely at the silver basin. And by appeared a vision of a pink-faced, golden-haired, overgrown cherub of a man walking about a quarterdeck. This, Mr. Horrocks assured them, was his cousin, Captain Barry.
"He looks very well, does he not?" cried Mr. Horrocks. "I'm glad to know he is in such good health."
"Where are they? Can you tell?"
Lord Mulgrave asked Mr. Norrell.
"Alas," said Mr. Norrell, "this art of making pictures is the most imprecise in the world."
Footnote 1. 4 years later, during the Peninsular War, Mr. Norrell's pupil, Jonathan Strange, had similar criticisms to make about this form of magic.
"I'm delighted to have had the honour of showing your lordship some of His Majesty's ships. I am yet more pleased that they are the ones you want, which is frankly more than I expected. But I fear I can tell you nothing further."
So delighted was the Admiralty with all that Mr. Norrell had accomplished that Lord Mulgrave and Mr. Horrocks soon looked about them to see what other tasks they could find for the magician. His Majesty's Navy had recently captured a French ship of the line with a very fine figurehead in the shape of a mermaid with bright blue eyes, coral pink lips, a great mass of sumptuous golden curls artistically strewn with wooden representations of starfish and crabs, and a tail that was covered all over with silver gilt, as if it might be made of gingerbread inside. It was known that before it had been captured, the ship had been at Toulon, Cherbourg, Antwerp, Rotterdam, and Genoa, and so the mermaid had seen a great deal of enemy defences and of the Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte's great scheme of shipbuilding, which was going forward at that time. Mr. Horrocks asked Mr. Norrell to put a spell on her so that she might tell all she knew. This Mr. Norrell did. But though the mermaid could be made to speak, she could not at first be brought to answer any questions. She considered herself the implacable enemy of the British, and was highly delighted to have been given powers of speech so that she could express her hatred of them. Having passed all her existence among sailors, she knew a great many insults, and bestowed them very readily on anyone who came near her, in a voice that sounded like the creaking of masts and timbers in a high wind. Nor did she confine herself to abusing Englishmen with words. There were three seamen that had work to do about the ship, but the moment that they got within reach of the mermaid's wooden arms, she picked them up in her great wooden hands and threw them in the water. Mr. Horrocks, who had gone down to Portsmouth to talk to her, grew tired of her, and told her that he would have her chopped up and made a bonfire of. But, though French, she was also very brave, and said she would like to see the man that would try to burn her. And she lashed her tail and waved her arms menacingly, and all the wooden starfish and crabs in her hair bristled. The situation was resolved when the handsome young captain who had captured her ship was sent to reason with her. He was able to explain to her, in clear, comprehensible French, the rightness of the British cause, and the terrible wrongness of the French one, and whether it were the persuasiveness of his words or the handsomeness of his face that convinced her, I do not know. But she told Mr. Horrocks all he wished to know. Mr. Norrell rose every day to new heights of public greatness, and an enterprising printmaker called Holland, who had a print shop in St. Paul's Churchyard, was inspired to commission an engraving of him to be sold in the shop. The engraving showed Mr. Norrell in the company of a young lady, scantily dressed in a loose smock. A great quantity of stiff, dark material swirled and coiled about the young lady's body without ever actually touching it, and for the further embellishment of her person, she wore a crescent moon tucked in among the tumbling locks of her hair. She had taken Mr. Norrell
who appeared entirely astonished by the proceedings, by the arm and was energetically pulling him up a flight of stairs and pointing in most emphatic manner towards a lady of mature years who sat at the top. The lady of mature years was attired, like the young lady, in a smock and draperies, with the handsome addition of a Roman helmet on her head. She appeared to be weeping in the most uninhibited fashion, while an elderly lion, her only companion, lay at her feet with a gloomy expression upon his countenance. This engraving, entitled "The Spirit of English Magic Urges Mr. Norrell to the Aid of Britannia," was an immense success, and Mr. Holland sold almost 700 copies in a month. Mr. Norrell did not go out so much as formerly. Instead, he stayed at home and received respectful visits from all sorts of great people. It was not uncommon for 5 or 6 coronet coaches to stop at his house in Hanover Square in the space of one morning. He was still the same silent, nervous little man he had always been, and had it not been for Mr. Drawlight and Mr. Lascelles, the occupants of those carriages must have found their visits dull indeed. Upon such occasions, Mr. Drawlight and Mr. Lascelles supplied all the conversation. Indeed, Mr. Norrell's dependence upon these two gentlemen increased daily. Childermas had once said that it would be an odd sort of magician that would employ Drawlight, yet Mr. Norrell now employed him constantly. Drawlight was forever being driven about in Mr. Norrell's carriage upon Mr. Norrell's business. Every day he came early to Hanover Square to tell Mr. Norrell what was being said about the town, who was rising, who was falling, who was in debt, who in love, until Mr. Norrell, sitting alone in his library, began to know as much of the town's business as any city matron. More surprising, perhaps, was Mr. Lascelles' devotion to the cause of English magic. The explanation, however, was quite simple. Mr. Lascelles was one of that uncomfortable breed of men who despise steady employment of any sort. Though perfectly conscious of his own superior understanding, he had never troubled to acquire any particular skills or knowledge, and had arrived at the age of 39 entirely unfitted for any office or occupation. He had looked about him and seen men who had worked diligently all the years of their youth risen to positions of power and influence, and there was no doubt that he envied them. Consequently, it was highly agreeable to Mr. Lascelles to become counsellor-in-chief to the greatest magician of the age and have respectful questions put to him by the king's ministers. Naturally, he made a great show of being the same careless, indifferent gentleman as before, but in truth, he was extremely jealous of his newfound importance. He and Drawlight had come to an understanding one night in the Bedford over a bottle of port. Two friends, they had agreed, were quite sufficient for a quiet gentleman such as Mr. Norrell, and they had formed an alliance to guard each other's interests and to prevent any other person from gaining any influence over the magician. It was Mr. Lascelles who first encouraged Mr. Norrell to think of publication. Poor Mr. Norrell was constantly affronted by people's misconceptions concerning magic, and was forever lamenting the general ignorance upon the subject. "They ask me to show them fairy spirits," he complained, "and unicorns and manticores and things of that sort. The utility of the magic I have done is entirely lost on them. It is only the most frivolous sorts of magic that excite their interests." Mr. Lascelles said, "Feats of magic will make your name known everywhere, sir, but they will never make your opinions understood. For that, you must publish." "Yes, indeed," cried Mr. Norrell eagerly, "and I have every intention of writing a book, just as you advise, only I fear it will be many years before I have leisure enough to undertake it." "Oh, I quite agree. A book would mean a world of work," said Mr. Lascelles languidly. "But I had no notion of a book. 2 or 3 articles was what I had in mind. I dare say there is not an editor in London or Edinburgh who would not be delighted to publish any little thing you cared to send them. You may make your choice of the periodicals, but if you take my advice, sir, you will choose the Edinburgh Review. There's scarcely a household in the kingdom with any pretensions to gentility that does not take it. There is no quicker way of making your views more widely understood." Mr. Lascelles was so persuasive upon the subject, and conjured up such visions of Mr. Norrell's articles upon every library table, and Mr. Norrell's opinions discussed in every drawing-room, that had it not been for the great dislike that Mr. Norrell had to the Edinburgh Review, he was sat down there and then to begin writing. Unfortunately, the Edinburgh Review was a publication renowned chiefly for radical opinions, criticism of the government, and opposition to the war with France, none of which Mr. Norrell could approve.
"Besides," said Mr. Norrell, "I really have no desire to write reviews of other people's books. Modern publications upon magic are the most pernicious things in the world, full of misinformation and wrong opinions."
"Then, sir, you may say so. The ruder you are, the more the editors will be delighted."
"But it is my own opinions which I wish to make better known, not other people's."
"Ha-ha, but sir," said Lascelles, "it is precisely by passing judgments upon other people's work and pointing out their errors that readers can be made to understand your own opinions better. It is the easiest thing in the world to turn a review to one's own ends. One only need mention the book once or twice, and for the rest of the article, one may develop one's theme just as one chooses. It is, I assure you, what everybody else does."
"Hmm," said Mr. Norrell thoughtfully. "You may be right. But no, it would seem as if I were lending support to what ought never to have been published in the first place."
And upon this point, Mr. Norrell proved unpersuadable. Lascelles was disappointed. The Edinburgh Review far surpassed its rivals in brilliance and wit. Its articles were devoured by everyone in the kingdom, from the meanest curate to the Prime Minister. Other publications were very dull in comparison. He was inclined to abandon the notion altogether, and had almost forgotten all about it, when he happened to receive a letter from a young bookseller named Murray. Mr. Murray respectfully requested that Mr. Lascelles and Mr. Drawlight would do him the honour of permitting him to wait upon them at any hour and upon any day to suit them. He had, he said, a proposal to put before them, a proposal which concerned Mr. Norrell. Lascelles and Drawlight met the bookseller at Mr. Lascelles' house in Bruton Street a few days later. His manner was energetic and businesslike, and he laid a proposal before them immediately. "Like every other inhabitant of these isles, gentlemen, I have been amazed and delighted at the recent extraordinary revival of English magic, and I've been equally struck by the enthusiasm with which the British public has greeted this reappearance of an art long thought dead. I'm convinced that a periodical devoted to magic would achieve a wide circulation. Literature, politics, religion, and travel are all very well. There'll always be popular subjects for a periodical, but magic, real practical magic, like Mr. Norrell's, has the advantage of complete novelty. I wonder, gentlemen, if you could tell me whether Mr. Norrell would look favourably upon my proposal. I've heard that Mr. Norrell has a great deal to say upon the subject. I have heard that Mr. Norrell's opinions are quite surprising. Of course, we all learnt a little of the history and theory of magic in our schoolrooms, but it was so long since any magic was practised in these islands that I dare say what we have been taught is full of errors and misconceptions."
"Ah," cried Mr. Drawlight, "how perceptive of you, Mr. Murray. How happy it will make Mr. Norrell to hear you say so. Errors and misconceptions, exactly so. Whenever, my dear sir, you are privileged to enjoy Mr. Norrell's conversation, as I have been upon many occasions, you will learn that such is the exact state of affairs."
"It has long been the dearest wish of Mr. Norrell's heart," said Lascelles, "to bring a more precise understanding of modern magic before a wider audience. But alas, sir, private wishes are often frustrated by public duties, and the Admiralty and the War Office keep him so busy." Mr. Murray replied politely that, of course, all other considerations must give way before the great consideration of the war, and Mr. Norrell was a national treasure. "But I hope that some way might be found to arrange matters so that the chief burden did not fall upon Mr. Norrell's shoulders. We would employ an editor to plan each issue, solicit articles and reviews, and make changes, all under Mr. Norrell's guidance, naturally."
"Ah, yes," said Lascelles,
"quite. All under Mr. Norrell's guidance. We would insist upon that." The interview ended very cordially upon both sides, with Lascelles and Drawlight promising to speak to Mr. Norrell immediately. Drawlight watched Mr. Murray leave the room.
"A Scotchman,"
he said, as soon as the door was closed.
"Ah, quite," agreed Lascelles. "But I do not mind that. The Scotch are often very able, very canny in business.
I believe this might do very well.
He seemed quite a respectable person, almost a gentleman, in fact, except that he has a queer trick of fixing his right eye upon one while his other eye travels the room. I found that a little disconcerting.
He is blind in his right eye.
Indeed?
Yes. Canning told me. One of his schoolmasters stuck a penknife in it when he was a boy.
Dear me. But just imagine, my dear Lascelles, a whole periodical devoted to one person's opinions. I would have never believed it possible. The magician will be astonished when we tell him.
Mr. Lascelles laughed.
He will consider it the most natural thing in the world. His vanity is beyond anything.
As Lascelles had predicted, Mr. Norrell found nothing extraordinary in the proposal, but straight away he began to make difficulties.
It is an excellent plan, he said, but unfortunately completely impracticable. I have no time to edit a periodical, and I could scarcely entrust so important a task to anyone else.
I was quite of the same mind, sir, said Mr. Lascelles, until I thought of Portishead.
Portishead? Who is Portishead?
Asked Mr. Norrell.
Well, said Lascelles, he was a theoretical magician, but
a theoretical magician? Interrupted Mr. Norrell in alarm. You know what I think of that.
Ah, but you have not heard what follows, said Lascelles. So great is his admiration of you, sir, that on being told you did not approve of theoretical magicians, he immediately gave up his studies.
Did he indeed?
Said Mr. Norrell, somewhat placated by this information.
He has published one or two books, I forgot what exactly, a history of 16th century magic for children, or something of that sort.
Footnote 2. In this speech, Mr. Lascelles has managed to combine all Lord Portishead's books into one. By the time Lord Portishead gave up the study of magic in early 1808, he had published three books. The Life of Jacques Bellasis, publisher Longman, London, 1801. The Life of Nicolas Goubert, publisher Longman, London, 1805. And A Child's History of the Raven King, published Longman, London, 1807. Engravings by Thomas Bewick. The first two were scholarly discussions of two 16th century magicians. Mr. Norrell had no great opinion of them, but he had a particular dislike of A Child's History. Jonathan Strange, on the other hand, thought this an excellent little book.
I really feel that you might safely entrust the periodical to Lord Portishead, sir. There's no danger of him publishing anything of which you disapprove. He is known as one of the most honourable men in the kingdom. His first wish will be to please you, I am quite certain.
Footnote 3. It was odd that so wealthy a man, for Lord Portishead counted large portions of England among his possessions, should have been so very self-effacing, but such was the case. He was, besides, a devoted husband and a father of 10 children. Mr. Strange told me that to see Lord Portishead play with his children was the most delightful thing in the world, and indeed he was a little like a child himself. For all his great learning, he could no more recognize evil than he could spontaneously understand Chinese. He was the gentlest lord in all of the British aristocracy. The Life of Jonathan Strange by John Segundus, publisher John Murray, London, 1820. Somewhat reluctantly, Mr. Norrell agreed to meet Lord Portishead, and Mr. Drawlight wrote a letter summoning him to Hanover Square. Lord Portishead was about 38 years of age. He was very tall and thin, with long, thin hands and feet. He habitually wore a whitish coat and light-coloured breeches. He was a gentle soul whom everything made uncomfortable. His excessive height made him uncomfortable. His status as a former theoretical magician made him uncomfortable. Being an intelligent man, he knew that Mr. Norrell disapproved of him. Meeting such polished men of the world as Drawlight and Lascelles made him uncomfortable. And meeting Mr. Norrell, who was his great hero, made him most uncomfortable of all. At one point, he became so agitated that he began to sway backwards and forwards, which, taken in conjunction with his height and whitish clothes, gave him the appearance of a silver birch tree in a high wind. Despite his nervousness, he managed to convey his great sense of the honour done to him in being summoned to meet Mr. Norrell. Indeed, so gratified was Mr. Norrell by Lord Portishead's extreme deference towards him that he graciously gave his permission for Lord Portishead to study magic again. Naturally, Lord Portishead was delighted.
But when he heard that Mr. Norrell desired him to sit for long periods of time in a corner of Mr. Norrell's own drawing-room, soaking up Mr. Norrell's opinions upon modern magic, and then to edit under Mr. Norrell's direction Mr. Murray's new periodical, it seemed that he could conceive of no greater happiness. The new periodical was named The Friends of English Magic, the title being taken from Mr. Secundus's letter to the Times in the previous spring. And curiously, none of the articles which appeared in The Friends of English Magic were written by Mr. Norrell, who was found to be entirely incapable of finishing a piece of writing. He was never satisfied with what he had written. He could never be sure that he had not said too much or too little. Footnote 4. The Friends of English Magic was first published in February 1808 and was an immediate success. By 1812, Norrell and Lascelles were boasting of a circulation in excess of 13,000, though how reliable this figure may be is uncertain. From 1808 until 1810, the editor was nominally Lord Portishead, but there is little doubt that both Mr. Norrell and Lascelles interfered a great deal. There was a certain amount of disagreement between Norrell and Lascelles as to the general aims of the periodical. Mr. Norrell wished the Friends of English Magic first to impress upon the British public the great importance of English modern magic, secondly, to correct erroneous views of magical history, and third, to vilify those magicians and classes of magicians whom he hated. He did not desire to explain the procedures of English magic within its pages. In other words, he had no intention of making it in the least informative. Lord Portishead, whose admiration of Mr. Norrell knew no bounds, considered it his first duty as editor to follow Norrell's numerous instructions. As a result, the early issues of The Friends of English Magic are rather dull and often puzzling, full of odd omissions, contradictions, and evasions. Lascelles, on the other hand, understood very well how the periodical might be used to gain support for the revival of English magic, and he was anxious to make it lighter in tone. He grew more and more irritated at Portishead's cautious approach. He manoeuvred, and from 1810, he and Lord Portishead were joint editors. John Murray was the publisher of The Friends of English Magic until early 1815, when he and Norrell quarrelled. Deprived of Norrell's support, Murray was obliged to sell the periodical to Thomas Norton Longman, another publisher. In 1816, Murray and Strange planned to set up a rival periodical to The Friends of English Magic, entitled The Famulus, but only one issue was ever published. There is not much to interest the serious student of magic in the early issues, and the only entertainment to be got from them is contained in several articles, in which Portishead attacks on Mr. Norrell's behalf gentlemen magicians, lady magicians, street magicians, vagabond magicians, child prodigy magicians, the Learned Society of York magicians, the Learned Society of Manchester magicians, learned societies of magicians in general, and any other magicians whatsoever. Chapter 13. The Magician of Threadneedle Street, December 1807. The most famous street magician in London was undoubtedly Vinculus. His magician's booth stood before the Church of St. Christopher Stocks in Threadneedle Street, opposite the Bank of England, and it would have been difficult to say whether the bank or the booth were the more famous. Yet the reason for Vinculus's celebrity, or notoriety, was a little mysterious. He was no better a magician than any of the other charlatans with lank hair and a dirty yellow curtain. His spells didn't work, his prophecies didn't come true, and his trances had been proven false beyond a doubt. For many years, he was much addicted to holding deep and weighty conference with the spirit of the River Thames. He would fall into a trance and ask the spirit questions, and the voice of the spirit would issue forth from his mouth in accents deep, watery, and windy. On a winter's day in 1805, a woman paid him a shilling to ask the spirit to tell her where she might find her runaway husband. The spirit provided a great deal of quite surprising information, and a crowd began to gather around the booth to listen to it. Some of the bystanders believed in Vinculus's ability and were duly impressed by the spirit's oration, but others began to taunt the magician and his client. One such jeerer, a most ingenious fellow, actually managed to set Vinculus's shoes on fire while Vinculus was speaking. Vinculus came out of his trance immediately. He leapt about, howling and attempting to pull off his shoes and stamp out the fire at one and the same time. He was throwing himself about, and the crowd were all enjoying the sight immensely, when something popped out of his mouth. Two men picked it up and examined it.
It was a little metal contraption, not more than an inch and a half long. It was something like a mouth organ, and when one of the men placed it in his own mouth, he too was able to produce the voice of the spirit of the River Thames. Despite such public humiliations, Vinculus retained a certain authority, a certain native dignity, which meant that he, among all the street magicians of London, was treated with a measure of respect. Mr. Norrell's friends and admirers were continually urging him to pay a visit to Vinculus, and were surprised that he showed no inclination to do it. One day in late December, when storm clouds made alpine landscapes in the sky above London, when the wind played such havoc in the heavens that the city was one moment plunged in gloom and the next illuminated by sunlight, when rain rattled upon the windowpane, Mr. Norrell was seated comfortably in his library before a cheerful fire. The tea-table, spread with a quantity of good things, stood before him, and in his hand was Thomas Lanchester's The Language of Birds. He was turning the pages in search of a favourite passage, when he was nearly frightened out of his wits by a voice suddenly saying very loudly and contemptuously,
"Magician, you think that you've amazed everyone by your deeds?"
Mr. Norrell looked up, and was astonished to find that there was someone else in the room, a person he had never seen before, a thin, shabby, ragged hawk of a man. His face was the colour of three-day-old milk, his hair was the colour of a coal-smoke-and ashes London sky, and his clothes were the colour of the Thames at dirty Wapping. Nothing about him, face, hair, clothes, was particularly clean, but in all other points he corresponded to the common notion of what a magician should look like, which Mr. Norrell most certainly did not. He stood very erect, and the expression of his fierce grey eyes was naturally imperious.
"Oh, yes," continued this person, glaring furiously at Mr. Norrell. "You think yourself a very fine fellow. Well, know this, magician. Your coming was foretold long ago. I've been expecting you these past 20 years. Where have you been hiding yourself?"
Mr. Norrell sat in amazed silence, staring at his accuser with open mouth. It was as if this man had reached into his breast, plucked out his secret thought, and held it up to the light. Ever since his arrival in the capital, Mr. Norrell had realized that he had indeed been ready long ago. He could have been doing magic for England's benefit years before. The French might have been defeated, and English magic raised to that lofty position in the nation's regard which Mr. Norrell believed it ought to occupy. He was tormented with the idea that he had betrayed English magic by his dilatoriness. Now it was as if his own conscience had taken concrete form and started to reproach him. This put him somewhat at a disadvantage in dealing with the mysterious stranger. He stammered out an inquiry as to who the person might be.
"I am Vinculus, magician of Threadneedle Street."
"Oh," cried Mr. Norrell, relieved to find that at least he was no supernatural apparition. "And you have come here to beg, I suppose? Well, you may take yourself off again. I do not recognize you as a brother magician, and I shall not give you anything, not money, not promises of help, not recommendations to other people. Indeed, I may tell you that I intend—"
"Wrong again, magician! I want nothing for myself. I've come to explain your destiny to you, as I was born to do."
"Destiny? Oh, it's prophecies, is it?" cried Mr. Norrell contemptuously. He rose from his chair and tugged violently at the bell pull, but no servant appeared.